Thank you all for being here. It's fitting that we're having this event today on the first Monday in October, which is the United States Supreme Court's first day. When the Supreme Court took the bench this morning, Justice Neil Gorsuch and Justice Brett Kavanaugh took the bench, in large part thanks to the two men behind me. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and former White House counsel Don McGahn brought a laser focus to their job when it came to judges. Never before has a president, with the help of his White House counsel, focused so intently on nominating judges, especially appellate judges, than has President Trump. And never before has a Senate Majority Leader been so successful in advising and consenting as to those judges than has Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Regardless of your politics, what President Trump and Senate Majority Leader McConnell have accomplished with respect to judges is historic. During the time that Don McGahn was President Trump's White House counsel, he and Senate Majority Leader McConnell worked together to nominate and confirm 84 federal judges. This includes 53 district judges and 29 circuit judges. And most importantly, it includes two Supreme Court justices, the latter of whom the Senate confirmed exactly 1 year and 1 day ago. For these reasons, the Federalist Society is honored to introduce to you Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and former White House counsel Don McGahn. Please join me in welcoming them.
Well, good afternoon, and thanks for the opportunity to be here. My first intersection with advise and consent, I was a young staffer for a junior Republican senator on the Judiciary Committee in the Nixon administration, and went through a couple of confirmations, both of which were defeated, and actually ended up writing a law journal article in the UK Law Journal after that experience. And upon reflection, everything I said was wrong. I was arguing, of course, for some kind of a judicial approach to this where the president was given great deference with regard to philosophy, and all the Senate should do is just see if they met the qualifications. Upon reflection, after all these years, there's no doubt that the confirmation process means whatever the Senate thinks at any given time. It's much like impeachment, which is in the news now. Some people think of it as a judicial type proceeding. It's a political decision. And so over the years, after I went to the Senate, obviously, I ended up having a good deal of experience with the confirmation process. One interim period before I went to the Senate, I was at the Justice Department briefly as a kind of lower political appointee. Got to go to staff meetings occasionally, and in the room were Bork, who was the Solicitor General, Scalia, who was head of OLC, and Larry Silberman, who was the Deputy Attorney General. They were all brilliant. They were all funny. I never opened my mouth. I'm afraid I'd say something stupid. And then 10 years later, Scalia's before the Judiciary Committee. I went through the Clarence Thomas confirmation, the Robert Bork confirmation, and various iterations of what advise and consent means in terms of the number of senators that would be required to process the nomination. To truncate my point, even though it was possible to filibuster judges, it just wasn't done until Bush 43. There are plenty of things that you can do that you don't do. And the tradition in the Senate was to give judicial appointments an up or down vote. And the biggest test of that was the Clarence Thomas nomination prior to Kavanaugh, arguably the most controversial Supreme Court nomination in history. Justice Thomas was confirmed 52-48. If you don't know this, it only takes one senator out of 100 to make you get 60 votes, just one. Ted Kennedy, Joe Biden, they were all after Thomas, but no one said you have to get 60 votes. So that's how firm the tradition was of a simple majority vote for judicial confirmations. Bush 43 gets elected, and my now counterpart, Chuck Schumer, then a freshman Democratic senator from New York, convened a seminar, and he invited Lawrence Tribe, that some of you have heard of, and Cass Sunstein, and they had a discussion about all of these crazy right-wing judges that Bush 43 was going to try to put on the circuit courts, and concluded the appropriate thing to do was to filibuster anybody he wanted to. So that set off about a multi-year back and forth in the Senate over what is going to be the threshold. And finally, Senator Reid in 2013 decided to set the threshold at a simple majority for everything on the executive calendar except the Supreme Court at 51 votes. We complained about it. We complained about the way it was done. But a couple years later, we're in the majority. And I got guys and gals pulling on my shirt, my coat sleeves, saying, well, why don't we change it back? And I said, well, we could. We didn't like the way they did it, but this is the way it was done for all these years, down until Bush 43. So even though I don't like the way they did it, I kind of like where we are. And we may actually benefit from this sometime. So, shortly after that, Justice Scalia passes away. And as some of you who are really into this know, I had just started a one-week, we were out of session for a week. I had just started a one-week vacation with my wife in the Caribbean, not planning on thinking much about politics or government for a week. As soon as the plane landed, I turned on my device and found out Justice Scalia had passed away. I went to my room, turned on the television, started thinking first about my relationship with him over the years, and second, fast forward as you always do in the political business to the present. And I sent out a statement saying, this vacancy will be filled by the person that's going to be elected president of the United States this November. Boom. Why did I do it so quickly? I had members all over the country and all over the world. I didn't want to have to deal with 52 different opinions when we got back about how we were going to handle it. And so I decided to lay down a marker and hope that people would fall in line. And with a few exceptions, they did. We also decided not to to have any hearings or any processing of the nomination, because it was my anticipation that President Obama would name a well-qualified person, and he did. He named an extremely well-qualified person. But I didn't want it to be about the person, I wanted it to be about the process. So we held firm. In the meantime, on the same day that Justice Scalia is announced as having passed away, and I put out my statement, we heard from the Trump campaign, and with that, I will hand the baton over to my colleague here to my right, my buddy and co-collaborator for several years, who was counsel to the Trump campaign. So tell us what was going on over in that camp as I put out my statement.
Well, thank you. I am really honored to be here. Appreciate your willingness to share the stage with me in your home state and refer to me as being to your right. Rand Paul was here earlier, who's sort of his own thing, but he gave a great speech this morning. That day that Scalia passed was a tough blow for all of us. I too learned at that point, my flip phone. My wife had texted me that Scalia had passed. There was a debate that night in the primaries, and at that point, Senator Cruz was the one talking most about judges, and the consensus of the judicial selection team within the campaign, which was basically me and the president, was he would probably have to talk about it. And these conversations were going on before you had publicly shown the courage and the vision that you did to nip in the bud what would otherwise have been a protracted process game. And at the debate, it turns out from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., whenever the debate began around 8, 9, first question out of the gate was, what about the Supreme Court Scalia's pass? And Trump got the question first and was actually able to come right back with a couple potential names, Bill Pryor and Diane Sykes. Judge Sykes had actually issued a really nice First Amendment opinion on campaign finance law. It was essentially McCutcheon before McCutcheon got to the court. So I was well aware of Sykes and her First Amendment jurisprudence. So for what that's worth, that's why her name, we have this in common as well. We both read the First Amendment the same way. We read the text. So that led to the idea of thinking about actually talking about real people for the Supreme Court, not doing it in the abstract. It's not every day that there's a live vacancy during a Supreme or during a presidential campaign. And from the president mentioning names in the debate, that led to a meeting in D.C. It happened to be at my law firm, where he actually said, why don't I put out a list publicly of people who could be the sort of people I would put on the Supreme Court? And it's been described that I fell out of my chair. I didn't literally fall out of my chair, but I thought that was a wonderful thing. We had already talked about and thought about names and different people, if for no other reason than that's what campaigns do. They try to prepare answers to obvious questions. But it was actually President Trump who said, I want to go public with a list of names. And then that took some time to put together. None of the people on the list were interviewed directly. It was all based upon their paper trail, which is a little bit different than what the traditional mindset had been over the years, where people wanted to avoid paper trails. This was almost a throwback to the Bork fiasco, which in so many ways is sort of the big bang of why we're all here today at the Federalist Society. It was really the Bork hearings. And the idea was that there was a school of thought that you don't want people who really have said much. It might be a little tough, you know, it might make the Senate a little uncomfortable. Well, knowing who we were going to have as majority leader, it didn't make any sense to worry about whether the Senate had thick enough skin or the ability to get something done. That was never a concern in my mind that there was ever going to be a problem in the Senate. It was going to be to make sure whoever was the next president nominated the right sort of people. So we actually did a vetting, read as many opinions as we could, and as it sort of got narrowed down, ended up with about 10 names, I think, was the first list. Many of them are now circuit judges, and we kind of hide everything in plain view, right? Even a number of people, interestingly, generationally, the old model used to be go to a law school, maybe clerk for a judge, go to D.C., hope you work at the Department of Justice, and kind of become a player in D.C. politics. A number of people moved home and became state Supreme Court justices or district judges or U.S. attorneys, right? Amul Thapar fits this model. And he was the president's first nominee to a circuit court. He was on the Supreme Court list. Strong recommendation of the leader. And really, once they got to know Amul, it was a pretty easy choice.
If I could, Don, let me go back to the campaign, though, and talk about the significance of the decision to have the list.
It had never been done.
Yeah. Well, here's the situation. At the time I announced we were not going to fill the vacancy, we didn't know who the nominee was going to be. By the time the list became pretty noticeable and an issue, it looked like Donald Trump might be the nominee.
That's actually true. The list was put out after he was the presumptive nominee.
Yeah.
It was right after the Indiana primary in May, so he was going to be the nominee. So this was not a situation where he felt like he had to put out something to appear more conservative than he is, because at that point it was him versus Ted Cruz, right? That was who was left. He waited till he was the presumptive nominee, then he came out with the list, which blew everybody's mind in Washington, D.C. Every consultant of any sort of traditional Republican stripe said, oh my God, it's over. If I had a dollar for every time a consultant said the Trump campaign was over, I'd be a rich man, because it was over every day, according to the usual Beltway consultants. And they said, what's he doing? You're supposed to be moderate now for the general. Not Trump. He comes out with a smash mouth list Supreme Court.
Well, and the significance of it was, I mean, here was a guy who was about to become our nominee who was doing fundraisers for Chuck Schumer 4 years ago. So there were a lot of us saying, what are we getting here? And the list reassured a whole lot of Republicans, beginning with Republican U.S. senators, that, okay, maybe he was doing fundraisers for Schumer 4 years ago, but looks like he may be okay on something that's really important to us, which is what kind of people are you going to put into these lifetime positions. Fast forward a little further, and by the fall, the single biggest issue that brought 9 out of 10 Republican voters home to Donald Trump, just like 9 out of 10 voted for Mitt Romney, was the Supreme Court. The fact that they had confidence that he would make the right kind of appointment. So the establishment of the list reassured a lot of skeptical Republicans on the inside, and then by the fall on the outside, and became the single biggest issue to bringing our side in line behind him and allowed him in part to win the election as a result of that.
I saw some polling data. The campaign really wasn't into polling. It's more of a data modeling system. But after the fact, a couple of reputable pollsters showed me some data where self-described independent voters, which is kind of a misnomer. I mean, I don't think independent voters go with the wind. I think they have a sense of who they are, and they don't necessarily fit neatly into a label that, or they don't want to be self-described, but setting that aside, number of independent voters were asked, you know, why did you vote the way you voted? And it was interesting, this data showed that they didn't really like Hillary Clinton and they didn't really like President Trump. He wasn't president then, Mr. Trump is what I called him. But they said, you know, Trump's talking about the court. And there's a vacancy and he's put out this list and he's talking about people who want to read the law and be judges and not do all this social engineering and, you know, sort of just a layman's description of how, you know, sort of Federalist Society's view of the role of judges. So it actually didn't just bring home Republicans. It actually made the difference with that critical group of voters that actually gave their vote to Trump, who maybe would not have, but for the fact that there was a vacancy, a list, a serious discussion about it, and Hillary Clinton seemed to be running from it and didn't want to really engage on it and just kind of laughed the whole thing off.
So let's go to election night. I had three things on my mind. One, I was really hoping we'd flip the state house in Kentucky for the first time in 100 years. That happened about 8:30 at night. I was hoping I was still going to be the majority leader of the Senate. That was very much in doubt. That happened about 11 o'clock at night. Never occurred to me we might actually elect the president as well. I'm sure all of you were totally confident Trump was going to win. I wasn't. And about 1:30 in the morning, Donald Trump's elected president of the United States. So the first thing that comes into my mind is these opportunities don't come along that often when you have the White House, the House, and the Senate. For those of you who are not American history junkies, you can go back 100 years, and my party's only controlled all three for 20 of the 100 years, one-fifth of the time. So I said, we don't want to waste any time here, and of the things that we can do, what's the most important? Obviously, the Supreme Court and the courts. Now, it won't surprise some of you to know that during the last 2 years of President Obama, when I was in charge of the agenda in the Senate, we didn't fill a lot of lifetime appointments. So there were a good number of vacancies sitting there. In fact, a record going back to the early 1950s. So the election's over. We have a new president. I read that Don McGahn is going to be the White House counsel. So I called Don.
I know him.
I called Don the week after the election, and we had a discussion, which I'm sure you remember, I remember every bit of it, talking about how to expedite the process.
Yeah, you gave me probably not probably, gave me the best advice anyone's given me about how to do it. I had a pretty good idea what needed to be done. I unfortunately have been a creature of the Beltway for most of my adult career, represented a number of senators, House members, governors, and the like. So I had a pretty good sense of you really need to make sure you can get people confirmed and all that kind of stuff, which honestly some White Houses don't quite anticipate. They take over and they think they just make nominations and that sort of thing. But I remember the one thing that cut through hot knife like butter is the leader said, just do this yourself. Don't have a committee. Don't get in all this bureaucracy. He's seen it in other White Houses. Without picking on the Bush White House, they had a multi-layer committee system which involved the council, the political affairs guy, the chief of staff, the senior counselor, this person, that person, the other person. And it really bogged things down. And Senator McConnell said, just to the extent you can grab the ball and run with it, just run. And I said, I thought that's a pretty good idea. Let me try that one. And that was actually something I then presented to the president-elect. And he did, that's good. Let's move. So, that to me, in addition to holding open the Supreme Court vacancy, the circuit vacancies, that was probably the most important thing that got us up on playing quickly. And we made a whole slew of nominations out of the gate, which in Senate terms is basically the first 6 months, because you think in terms of kind of half year, with the 2 year cycle, you break it down. And honestly, the minority party, the Democrats, really didn't see it coming. And by the time they kind of woke up, we had already had a number of people move through the Senate, at least through part of the process. Now, the other thing going on was, of course, the Supreme Court vacancy, which was its own kettle of fish. And the second key there, we talked about that in some detail, about the Senate calendar. Now, I shouldn't say this because there's a book out by a reporter from the New York Times that makes me look like a genius for having put together a memo that guessed the date Neil Gorsuch would be confirmed basically to the day. And it does, we did an internal memo. It was written soon after I spoke to you. But really, if you take out the Senate calendar and you realize how the Senate calendar works, you can actually kind of figure out when this is gonna happen. And we worked backwards. We wanted somebody on the court that term in time to participate in cases before all the matters were submitted and the opinions started rolling out in June. So we kind of worked from that period back. And that was part of the conversation and part of what you put in my head was pay attention to the Senate calendar. Don't just assume this happens by happenstance.
Yeah, and remember when the Democratic majority in 2013 changed the threshold, they did it for everything on the executive calendar except the Supreme Court. So the first visit I had with the president-elect up in Trump Tower, I said, remember, they can still filibuster this Supreme Court vacancy. All of my members argued against changing the rules back in 2013 with a simple majority. You need to send us the very best qualified person you can find anywhere in the country. And they did. On Don's good advice, he sent up Neil Gorsuch. If you were calling up Central Casting and said, send me the perfect Supreme Court justice, this would be the guy. And so we still were confronting a 60-vote threshold.
That's true.
For this nomination. By the time we got ready to move after he came out of committee, it was clear to me that Schumer was advising his members to filibuster the Supreme Court nominee. Honestly, I thought that was a mistake. I probably could not have gotten 51 of my members to do what we had argued against just a few years before and use a simple majority to lower the threshold to 51 had we not had such an extraordinarily well-qualified candidate. So when it became clear we were not going to be able to get 60 votes, I argued to my colleagues, look, if this guy, Neil Gorsuch, can't get 60 votes in this Senate, there's no one, no well-qualified, strict constructionist, no one, who could be confirmed by the Senate. So his outstanding qualifications, John, were what allowed me to get my members to do what they had argued against 4 years before. Had he been a little less qualified or more questionable, I don't think I could have lined up that many votes to do what we had argued against 4 years before. And so we did lower the threshold to 51, and he got 55 votes, I think, in the end, which showed you we wouldn't have gotten to 60. That's how we got him on the court. In the meantime, Donis and the president are sending up these outstanding young men and women. One of my favorite weeks, while you were still there, we confirmed a 37-year-old woman for the Fourth Circuit and a 39-year-old man for the Sixth Circuit in the same week. And now, even though Don's gone back into the private sector, we're at 43 circuit judges, 152 Article III judges overall, and my motto for the rest of the year is leave no vacancy behind.
Well, you also, I mean, you've also done something that's helped, which is cut back on, all due respect to the Senate, the lack of debate that was called debate on district judge and even circuit judge nominees. The Democrats were burning the clock on everyone. Another sort of, you want to talk about who's compromising norms and throwing out norms of polite DC society. Look at the Democrats in the Senate. They would burn every procedural move, every minute off the clock they could on every single nominee, even if it was a district court nominee from a Democratic state where both home state senators had returned their blue slip, which is the customary piece of paper they returned to the committee that allows the nominee to proceed, they would still slow walk everyone. So the uptick in district judges now that are getting confirmed is also due to you having the sense to talk your colleagues into, you know, peeling back some of their procedural shenanigans. I still don't understand why the Democrats, though, talked about filibustering Gorsuch. I thought that was just
a mistake of a century. Because I think it would have
would have saved it for the next one.
Yeah, absolutely. It would have been, given the controversy, we'll get to Kavanaugh in a minute, but given the controversy surrounding the second nomination, it would have been a lot harder for me to convince 51 of my members in the wake of all of that controversy to lower the threshold. So it was a mistake. And I think it was driven by what could best be described as Trump derangement syndrome.
And it's getting worse.
They were just making everything difficult. We had to vote, we had to have recorded votes on non-controversial cabinet members and assistant secretaries of this, that, or the other. I had to file cloture. You all know what that is. I'm not gonna waste any time explaining it to you. 138 times the first 2 years of the Trump administration. Let's put that in context. You can go back to the last six presidents before Trump, six of them, and the number of times the majority leader of whichever party was in the majority had to file cloture in order to advance a nomination on the executive calendar cumulatively. First 2 years, six presidents, numbers of times, majority leader had to file cloture, cumulatively 24 times. I had to do it 128 times in 2 years. Not just on lifetime appointments, but on assistant secretaries of this, that, or the other. So it clearly was designed just to try to eat up time. And what I did in order to prioritize the judges is I would put them first. So no matter how much time they wanted to spend on a circuit judge, we spent it. And we did them, and we're still doing them. And that level of obstruction continues. But ironically, now that the House is in Democratic hands, our legislative agenda is a lot shorter than it was. So even though if they want me to spend more time confirming judges, throw me into that briar patch. That's what we do.
And it hadn't always been this way. You mentioned earlier past votes. Thomas, for example, 52 votes for his Supreme Court nomination, but without a filibuster. it's circuit. The other change that I see is on the circuit courts. Go back to the 80s. President Reagan is known as someone who really moved the needle on judicial selection. But when you really break it down, it's really the D.C. circuit picks that were his legacy picks. And these were, and if you look at them, I think there was about eight of them. Only one had a recorded vote. It was Judge Buckley. The rest went through on some form of unanimous consent. And in case you think, well, maybe he put a bunch of sort of shrinking violets on there, it was people named like Scalia and Bork and Silberman. And I mean, the list goes down. It's honestly, it's sort of the Federalist Society all-stars were the ones put on then. And they got through the Senate without a lot of fanfare. And even if you look at Thomas, he was waved through the Senate. And a year later, he went through the ringer for the Supreme Court. He was only on the D.C. Circuit for a year. Been Senate confirmed a number of times before. I think the Supreme Court confirmation was his fourth confirmation. Now, every circuit nom is a mini Supreme Court hearing. All the Democrats show up. Most of the Republicans show up. TV cameras are there. Gotcha questions from start to finish. When Gorsuch went through to the 10th Circuit, Lindsey Graham showed up, asked him two questions. I don't recall the Democrat who showed up. And it was about a 20-minute hearing, and that included the pleasantries at the beginning. And he moved on. Ray Kethledge, a circuit judge who's been bandied about potential Supreme Court nominee, I paid attention to his confirmation because he actually went through the Senate the same day I did for the Federal Election Commission. He went through right before me on unanimous consent. So judges used to go through on unanimous consent. They do not anymore. And that is something that's also bogging it down. So it's amazing, without being too, buttering up too much, it's amazing how much you're able to get done in the Senate, which is not a swift-moving operation. For a number of sound historical reasons, but to overcome the amount of obstruction and the amount of change the Democrats have brought in. You know, when they got rid of the filibuster, my view is that it was done because they had a lot of trouble. Obama's people were not winning any cases in the D.C. Circuit. Every agency in the Obama administration, I think without exception, lost one, if not two, major regulatory overreach cases. Either they're beyond statutory authority, or they were making it up as they go along. And until they were able to stack the D.C. Circuit after the so-called nuclear option of Harry Reid, they didn't win. And all of a sudden, now they're winning. So the D.C. Circuit is not what it was up until that point. And, they made their bed and they're lying in it now. And it's kind of ironic is the word, that now one of the main themes that ties together President Trump's nominees is a healthy skepticism of the unelected bureaucracies in D.C. So amazing how it goes full circle, where now you have a whole new generation of judges coming on with some fresh thinking on the very issue that caused Reid to decide to blow up the norm and allow the D.C. Circuit to be loaded up.
Just an observation about the Senate. The coin of the realm in the Senate is floor time. It is so easy for any member, any of the 100, to make it take more time, because mostly we operate on unanimous consent. I'm asking consent to do something at a particular time. Unanimous consent means unanimous consent. If anybody objects, you can't. It means you may take 3 days to get a bill across the floor or to get a nomination across the floor. So what you have to have in that environment is a sense of what your priorities are. And the reason we've done all these circuit judges and will ultimately do all the district judges is because it's been my top priority. I have to put it ahead of something else, this bill or that bill or this nomination or that nomination. And why? It's pretty obvious. Lifetime appointments. If you want to have an impact on the country, there are not many things that we do that can't be undone by the next election. I remember back when we were talking about the tax bill, and we'd have people who were coming and working on various parts of the tax bill saying, well, this part is permanent and this part isn't. I said, when it comes to taxes, the only thing permanent depends on the outcome of the next election. But there's not much you can do about a young, strict constructionist who's committed for a lifetime to the quaint notion that maybe the job of the judge is to follow the law. You wouldn't think that'd be controversial, would you? But that basically was what Scalia and Bork were talking about when they started the Federalist Society at Chicago and Yale all those years ago, was to try to develop a network of people that Don tapped into so skillfully, of people who believe the job of a judge to follow the law. Scalia used to say, you're not a very good judge if you're not occasionally uncomfortable with the outcome you reach, because it's not your personal opinion. Or he would also say, if you want to make policy, why don't you run for office? That's not what we do here. Or Justice Gorsuch, some of you may have been there when I had him down here at both U of L and UK in 2017. He said, we don't wear red robes or blue robes, we wear black robes. So that network was out there, thanks to these giants of our profession, that Don could reach into and the president could send us. And we're going to be able to do that at least until December 31st of next year, for sure.
And hopefully beyond. I'll quibble with one point. I don't like to think of it as that we reached into a network. I was the president of the Federalist Society at my law school, been a member the whole time. The Democrats, remember the talking point, the idea we outsourced nominations to the Federalist Society? We didn't outsource anything, we insourced it. Every member of my team in the White House counsel's office was a member of the Federalist Society. We all came of age post-Bork, post-Thomas. And if you look at almost all the nominees, particularly for circuit courts, presidents put up, they all fit that mold of a sort of post-Borkian, post-Thomas hearing person who came of age within the confines of the Federalist Society. So it wasn't that we were able to tap into the network. We are the network. And it was really amazing opportunity the president gave me, the trust he gave me on this is still humbling to this day, that I was able to help him come up with people, many of whom I've known for years and years and years, because I'd go to Federalist Society concerts, conventions. Sometimes they're concerts. You hear me speak at Federalist Society, it's kind of like a concert. But it is a tremendous network, but it's not the caricature that the Democrats tried to portray it. It's something, and it's also a change from, say, the past Republican administration, when Federalist Society was kind of seen as another issue group that they maybe check with, but it'd be on a list of things. It's not where we are now. We are one and the same.
Why don't we fast forward to the announcement of Justice Kennedy?
No, that was quite the day. Some of us may have a feeling that may have been coming, but Kennedy announced he was going to retire. This was after the term had ended, so a couple days had gone by. So the media hype had died down slightly. There was a foreign leader at the White House that day coming in one door. So we brought Justice Kennedy basically in the other door in plain view, and no one noticed because the media is very attentive to whatever they think is the thing to see. And we went from there and ran our process. And another opportunity that took a little, maybe a little. Wasn't quite as A to B to C as we maybe had hoped it to be, but, you know, like Al Davis, the owner of the Oakland Raiders, once said, just win, baby.
Well, the goal was to get the next justice on the Supreme Court by the first Monday in October. One thought I had, not an argument for not nominating Brett Kavanaugh at all, but that one thing the Democrats would certainly use was the amount of paper. He'd had a lot of public positions. And clearly, if you were trying to slow walk this, you would want to see every shred of paper that ever passed his desk. And that required, obviously, Chairman Grassley to use some discretion about just what was going to be turned over and what wasn't. And so why don't you share some of the thoughts you all were having back and forth on paper production?
Well, Justice Kavanaugh had been a D.C. Circuit judge for a number of years, and he had publicly available opinions, quite a few of them. So the ordinary paper trail was there. But he had also had a couple jobs before that, one of which was a job called staff secretary in the White House, and this is the person who is, in theory, the hub of all paper that goes to the president. So they're the ones that touch every piece of paper, prepare for presidential signature and the like. And the Democrats tried to make a bunch of noise that they had to see all the documents that Kavanaugh touched, created, otherwise managed while he was staff secretary. We thought that was ridiculous because that had nothing to do with his views, how he would be as a judge, and that just seemed kind of dilatory. And then this other tranche of documents was when he worked for Ken Starr as a special counsel. We had a pretty good handle on the Starr documents. We actually were able to get through those rather quickly. A lot of them were in the archives. And even the staff sec documents, with modern word searches and things, we were pretty comfortable there was nothing in there that was going to be fatal. The only thing potentially fatal was the timing. So I do have to acknowledge Chairman Grassley as the unsung hero time and time again on so much of this, on managing the process with the documents. My thought was the more the Democrats want to make this about documents, the better. People don't care about documents. What's this judge going to be as a judge? Regular people in America are not going to get all wrapped around the axle on whether we see every piece of paper this guy produced as staff secretary, whatever that is. So the Democrats burned a lot of energy, I thought, on talking about process and documents, and they didn't really get around to talking about Kavanaugh's judicial philosophy till basically the hearings. And by that point, the die had been cast on his judicial philosophy, and they tried to score some points, but they really couldn't, because he's just very, very strong as a judge, particularly on administrative law and sort of the kind of issues, separation of powers, constitutional law, fundamentals that go to the Supreme Court. So the documents, I was kind of glad the Democrats were talking about the documents, because it had nothing to do with whether he was going to be a judge.
Yeah, and Grassley made an important point. He basically ruled out the staff secretary,
right,
papers, which left you with Whitewater.
Much more of a manageable thing.
Yeah, the Whitewater and the job he had in the White House, it was not staff secretary, and his decisions. So it looked like we were right on schedule. Everything was moving in the right direction. And boom.
I shouldn't say this, but I will. Then Susan Collins wanted to give a floor speech about how she really liked Kavanaugh. And then that week, boom. when they sensed that we had the votes, boom.
And so that led to an extremely dramatic couple of weeks. In fact, a year ago yesterday, Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed. Once the Christine Blasey Ford availability became public, there was no question that we needed to hear from her. And both sides thought that. And Justice Kavanaugh, obviously, Judge Kavanaugh then, was certainly going to want to defend himself. And one of the dilemmas we had on the Judiciary Committee, given the allegations, in spite of my begging and pleading some of the women Republican senators over the years to go on the Judiciary Committee, I had failed. And so we didn't have a single female Republican on the Judiciary Committee. By the way, we have two now. I'll fix that. But so it put us in an awkward position given the nature of the allegations. And we ended up hiring a lawyer from Arizona, I think she was.
She was a prosecutor from Arizona.
Who basically did the questioning for us, because we didn't like the optics left over even from the Clarence Thomas period, when the perception was that you had a bunch of men on the committee kind of piling on. And so I had no members on my side of the aisle who were interested in asking questions of Christine Blasey Ford, and you can understand why. So we had someone else do that. I remember talking to the president before the hearing, and we were both obviously equally interested in what transpired. I remember talking to him after Ms. Ford testified, and we both agreed she did a good job. And I suggested maybe that was halftime, and maybe we ought to talk again at the end of the day, and we did. And both of us felt that Justice Kavanaugh had done an excellent job, and there was no discussion of withdrawing the nomination. And in fact, at that point, I think I can safely say Judge Kavanaugh certainly was hoping that there would be a vote. And because his reputation, again, from his point of view, his reputation had been severely tarnished here, and he wanted to have a vote, and the president was not interested in withdrawing, and I wasn't interested in his withdrawing either.
Can I jump in on that for a second?
Interject.
I'm not sure there's any other president who wouldn't have cut and run. I mean, because I was on the Hill in the sort of Kavanaugh bubble. He did not watch it. He came in later. But we watched the morning session of that day from on TV because I wanted to see how everyone else was going to see it. We didn't sit in the room and do that sort of thing. But what was odd was the buzz on Capitol Hill was that the more she did not remember, the more credible she seemed to become. And it was something we kind of anticipated, which is part of why the Republican senators asking questions seemed to probably not be the best use of time. But I got to tell you, other circumstances, other errors, other times, I could have easily seen people cutting and running. But President Trump, I mean, once he digs in, he digs in. I mean, he hung in there and really looked to you, just given the temperature of the Senate, and you hung in there. But in other times, I mean, Brett could have been left twisting in the wind. And, you know, there was a buzz that this was not looking good, but then he came out, reset the room, essentially. I thought did a brilliant job defending himself, put it all on the line. And I just wanted to interject, you know, it was not a foregone conclusion that he was going to remain the nominee. There were a number of articles that morning, you know, the people in the White House, all these anonymous sources, you know, the White House is considering this, that, and the other. Well, you know, I was a counsel to the president. I was on Capitol Hill. I wasn't considering anything. The president, he wasn't considering anything. I don't know who these White House people are who are reconsidering. But in another time, another place, I could have easily seen groupthink come in and think, we got to move to plan B.
I had two things on my mind. One was this needed to come to a conclusion for two reasons. Number one, Judge Kavanaugh deserved a vote. He deserved a vote. And number two, if he didn't make it, I wasn't sure at that point we'd still be in the majority this year. So how much time would it have taken to process a plan B? So there were a whole lot of reasons to press this through to a conclusion. The hearing at which both of them testified was on a Thursday. The Judiciary Committee met on Friday, and then we got a surprise. I thought all the votes were lined up. One of our colleagues, Jeff Flake, during the course of the meeting, had an epiphany after discussing the matter with Chris Coons, one of the Democrats, and Jeff decided to vote to report Kavanaugh out of committee, but to withhold his vote on the floor until we had a subsequent FBI investigation. So, Kavanaugh comes out of committee on Friday morning. I call the committee Republicans over to my office, plus two other members who I knew were undecided, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, and we discussed what the subsequent FBI investigation would be. Because I said, we need to give the White House the scope of the investigation. But I want all of you to know, we're going to vote a week from now. We're going to vote a week from now. So we need to think seriously about who do you want to talk to. So we had a discussion. It was agreed that anybody Dr. Ford recommended who could corroborate her story obviously needed to be talked to. There was a woman at Yale named Ramirez. who had made some allegations, talked to her and anybody she recommends. This lawyer, Avenatti, who's subsequently been totally disgraced, everybody in the room said, we're not interested in anybody that Avenatti claims to represent.
So I mean, honestly, between President Trump and you, there is a third person that really was should get the game ball for getting Kavanaugh over the finish line. It is Michael Avenatti. Because the day he burst on the scene, I said, no, he's here. This is good news. This is good news.
So I excused myself, went into my office from the conference room where we had this meeting, also in my office, but into another place. I called Don and I said, here's the scope. These are the individuals that need to be talked to. And so by Thursday, the FBI had reported back that they had spoken to everyone that either of these two individuals had mentioned. They filed a report, and the Democrats said, we want the report released. Fortunately, I had a memo between Barack Obama and Pat Leahy saying that FBI reports are not to be copied and are to be returned to the executive branch when finished. So I said, we're not copying it, we're not releasing it, but if you want to go look at it, you can. And so stayed in, made it available to anybody in the Senate who wanted to go read the FBI reports. A number of members did. The only members who were really important, in my opinion, were Joe Manchin, Jeff Flake, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski. The next day was, that was a Thursday, the next Thursday a week after the hearing. The next day was a Friday, and Susan Collins, I think in one of the most effective and memorable speeches in the history of the Senate, walked through absolutely everything from beginning to end. And given the nature of her very blue state, cast a very courageous vote for Brett Kavanaugh, and that basically determined the outcome. Manchin, I thought we'd get all along, and Flake, we did get in the end. And so it went from looking like a pretty smooth passage to quite a dramatic episode in the Senate. In the meantime, the people who were enraged about all of this were descending on the Capitol. I mean, they were literally getting in members' faces in the Russell Building and the Dirksen Building and showing up in restaurants and acting out. We have a serious civility problem right now in the country. And the people who were opposed to Justice Kavanaugh were acting out in all kinds of ways. And ironically, Don, I think it actually helped steal my members, made them even more determined. And the political irony of it all was the Democrats last fall were totally fired up. What finally got us on fire was the Kavanaugh event. It actually ended up helping us politically. And as you may have noticed, we gained two seats in the Senate while the House was going south. And I think that the controversy surrounding the Kavanaugh nomination was like an adrenaline shot to a fairly sleepy right-of-center public going into the off-year election that all of a sudden realized the significance of the Senate, the importance of the Senate, and we ended up having a pretty good election day while it wasn't that great overall.
Definitely brought things back into focus and reminded people what's important. What's important. The protesters, I agree with you, they ended up helping us in a weird way. I remember in the hearing, we'll call it Kavanaugh 1, not Kavanaugh 2. Kavanaugh 1, right out of the gate, the screeching protesters and, you know, people had to be escorted out. And for some reason, they kept coming back in. And I remember looking at the Democratic members, Dianne Feinstein all the way down. She looked very troubled. I mean, it was embarrassing for them. And my thought was, these are their people, and they're looking appalled at this stuff. This is distracting, but it's not bad. Remember, Chairman Grassley got a little bit of criticism that morning because he let the Democrats kind of run wild.
Turns out it was probably the right call because it got it out of their system, and then it was able to sort of. But yeah, he does things his way, very effective, and it was very effective that how he handled it. And then later, you know, Kavanaugh too, there was just people everywhere, signed outside the Capitol, just running around, and it just incoherent, because if you'd ask them any substantive questions, they didn't really seem to know much in the way of substance, but. You know, let's not have that get in the way of a good protest. And then the third thing was, you know, when Senator Flake said he's going to withhold his vote, he was very clear he wanted a limited scope and timing investigation. And there was this push about, well, we knew the investigation was never going to be what the lefty Democrats wanted. Because it's never going to be enough, because as everything else they were doing was always buy more time, buy more time, buy more time. But I do remember when the report went over to the Hill and senators had a chance to look at it. I can't get into what was in the report, but it struck me that a number of senators came out and basically essentially told you, we're ready to vote now. Let's go to the floor. We're feeling good. Let's vote. And that kind of tells you, without telling you what's in the report, right? I mean, they came out feeling pretty good and really were ready to speak on the floor and vote. And it all seemed to work out.
It did indeed. Do we have time for a question or two from the... I'm ready for questions.
Okay, we'll jump right to a couple of questions.
Who's asking the question? I'm sorry. Are there any
questions?
Maybe
that was a bad idea I had.
All right.
Okay, well, I guess we're...
We left him speechless, Leader.
Don, I want to thank you for coming to Kentucky.
Wonderful. Yeah, I appreciate the invite, and it's an honor to be here on the stage with you in your home state. It's really a special day for me.
Well, we had... a great bonding relationship for a couple of years, and it gives me a lot of pride, and I know you as well, to have participated in something this important for the country and this long-lasting. And it's always a pleasure to be in front of a bunch of lawyers who think the job of a judge is to follow the law. And we don't always see that. And personally very grateful for the Federalist Society network and, you know, thrilled that young lawyers are getting this kind of positive reinforcement for such views of what the law ought to be and how it ought to be approached. And so thank you for letting us be here. Thank you for coming down, Don.
Sure. And if I could just echo the thought on the Federalist Society. I mentioned earlier I've been a member forever. But in so many ways, what you've done, what President Trump has done, is the logical conclusion of what so many of us in the Federalist Society have been working toward. And I get I'm a very lucky man because I, in a lot of ways, was in the right place at the right time. But I am also the logical conclusion of the Federalist Society, having been a young lawyer in the early 90s, going to Federalist Society events, meeting people. And eventually you get to a certain age, you look around, the people you met years ago end up being the people who now you want to put on the bench. Maybe they're running the Senate, you just never know. It's something that I think is going to be very special going forward. Where there's a whole new generation of judges and people who are invested in this, and it's convenient I get to sit up here and act like it was me, but it was very much a team effort from a number of people, from Leonard Leo, Rob Luther's here who worked for me in the White House, he's now with me at my firm, and so many people in between, people on your staff, people on Chairman Grassley's staff, but all of this really comes out of this thought that a handful of law professors had years and years ago, which has now resulted in where we are today. So what we do here, I really think matters. And I want to thank everybody here, being part of this debate that we're having. And we're to the point now where in the Federalist Society, you can really debate original public meaning in a meaningful way of constitutional law. There's different schools of thought now. It's not just simple who reads the law and who doesn't. It's really an exciting time. And it was really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to sort of get to interview people who are growing on the federal bench and really have these discussions in a way that is a very special thing. And to be here with you today is another one of these things that I'm not sure what I did to deserve this. But thank you for the opportunity to be here. And with that, I think Terry Carmack is giving us the nod. And when Terry gives us the nod.
Thanks again, everyone.